What's up, everybody? Not My House is in the house. This is your host, Eric. And as always, right next to me is my co-host, Zach. Zach, what's going on this morning, my friend?
I'm excited. It's been a while since we posted an episode. We took a little break, but we got a good one today. Gene's always hooking it up with the assists with guests, and we're just really excited for this one today.
Absolutely. He holds the record for the most points in a high school game in Long Island, where he scored 76 points. He played his college hoops at Florida and Tennessee State. He was drafted in the fifth round by the 76ers in 1983. He's a professor in finance. We're honestly honored to have him on the show today, Mr. Mike Milligan. How are you doing today, sir?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thank you guys for having me. I look forward to this. You know, I'm a lot older now, and you're going to ask me to pull up memories, but I'm going to do my best to pull up some memories. They're all good. You know, we always put the bad ones behind us. So I'm going to tell you only the good stuff, not the bad stuff.
Awesome. Awesome. You don't have that Long Island accent. What happened?
Well, kind of funny. When I got back to New York after my basketball career, when I finally said, okay, it's time for me to, you know, get a real job and stop playing hoops, I was a wealth manager, broker, and I literally cold called the country. So one of the things I worked on was trying to remove my New York accent, and more or less trying to sound basically just neutral so I could appeal to people across the country.
See, that's impressive, man, because my dad's from Brooklyn, grew up in Brooklyn, born and raised. He's lived in Vegas for like 30 years, and he still sounds like he's in the mob.
You should hear my sisters talk. They live in Phoenix now, but when they talk, I always say, "Oh, coffee, Long Island." I'm like, "Okay."
So you grew up back east. I'm assuming Little League baseball might have been your first forte into sports, or was it basketball?
That's a great question. It actually was Little League baseball. You're right. How about that?
Yeah.
You know, I'm the youngest of four kids. And I have three older sisters. So a lot of my sports came from literally me just getting on my bike and going to play sports and join teams. And the neighborhood kids would say, "Hey, Mike, come on, let's go here." And I would go with them, especially the older kids, because I was somewhat big for my age. So a lot of the older kids would take me with them to go play basketball, baseball, football, all that.
That's awesome. And, you know, New York, obviously known for its playground hoops. We hear about the Joe Hammonds, Pee Wee Kirklands, Earl Manigolds, so many greats. And I feel like during your time is probably a really great time for playground basketball. So how important was the blacktop game for your development as a player? And did you go up against any familiar playground legends that our listeners might know?
All right. Well, a couple of things here. One is you are so, so correct. I was literally on the phone this morning. It's kind of ironic. I was on the phone this morning with a kid who grew up down the block from me who was 2 years older than me. And he literally was my basketball mentor. He really, you know, it's funny because he and I were talking about it. He's the one that says, "I don't care how many points you got, how many rebounds you get, how many assists you get." And this was when he was talking to me when I was in like seventh and eighth grade playing basketball. He also is the one that got me using my left hand. He's like, "Hey, use your left hand." So it's kind of funny you say that. The other thing that he and I talked about, and this is truly the guys who play pickup ball in New York, you learn how to win ball games. Because when you go to the park and you're not the best player in the park, which I wasn't as a youth, you learn that if you don't win, you literally might be sitting for the next 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah, or the day.
You might be done for the day and going home.
Depending what park it is, yeah.
So, and the other thing too was, there was no soft fouls. You couldn't call a foul if it was soft. It's like, no, you're not getting that call. So guys would hammer you. They're like, "I'll just foul you because there's no fouling out, and I'll foul you, and that way, you know, I don't lose." So you learned how to score. You learned how to win under what we call adverse situations. The other thing you learn, though, is, and this is funny, "Hey, Eric, you're on my team, and we're trying to win. Eric, you're not a good shooter. Stop shooting. Do something to win the ball game." So you learn how to, and I don't say the word manipulate, but you learn how to visualize and realize what your teammates' strengths and weaknesses are, and you play towards them so you can win the game. And then, as the saying goes, yell to the team, "Get off next. Who's got next?" So yeah. that was the environment I grew up in. And then for me, because of my size, now don't get me wrong, I'm not 6'10", I'm only 6'5". But as a kid, I was taller than most of my classmates. I always end up playing with the older kids. And it was funny because as I play with the older kids, I would then go back to my age group and do all the things that they did to me, I would do to my age group.
Yeah.
So no. I mean, that's how I learned the game in middle school. I'm quite sure if you looked at my background, you might have saw I went to high school.
Right.
My high school, when I was in high school, we were nationally ranked every year. We were number one my sophomore year, number two my junior year. My senior year, we weren't that ranked. I played high school basketball with a four-year All-American. All-Americans came before me. All-Americans are coming out after me. So that also played a major role in my development. Major role. I can't emphasize enough. And I didn't realize how lucky and special that was for me until I got older and started seeing some of the other high school and college coaches and talking to teammates. And, you know, the benefit I had coming out of my high school was I was fundamentally ready to play Division I basketball. You know, athletically, of course, but I understood how to work on the court. I understood how to move. I understood the game. But I wasn't the only one. I'm saying right. That my high school coach did that with all of us. The other thing my high school coach did with all of us is it was the John Wooden philosophy, and that is if you're a basketball player, you need to know how to dribble, pass, shoot, defense, and rebound. So I went to a high school where our coach would say, if I want to, I could have my center bring the ball down court and feed my point guard in the low post and have him go score. He said, I can find whatever mismatch there is on the court, I can find it and exploit it because my players can all dribble, pass, shoot, and rebound. Some did other things better than others, but we all could do that. And so it was weird for me because in high school, I played the small forward, a wing. When I got to college, they actually moved me to point guard. Oh, and wow. The reason being was it was a coaching decision. I'm trying to be polite about this. A coaching decision. My roommate should have been the starting point guard. But you know how college coaches are, you know, things happen, whatever goes on. And they decided not to play him and move me to point. And he and I were the only ones that could bring the ball down court against pressure. He and I were the only ones that could make an entry pass to the wing. So like a lot of players at my height, 6'5", you know, I had, you know, 38, 39 inch vertical, all that good stuff. I would snatch a rebound on defense and push it up court and start the break. And yeah. When I first got to Florida, I'd snatch a rebound and go down court and they were all standing there watching me. And my high school coach who taught me all this was also the coach at Florida, assistant coach. And he stood there and said, go with him. He'll pass you the ball. Go with him. He'll pass you the ball. And so guys started realizing, oh, he will pass. So I would snatch a rebound, head down court, and I'd get the wings. And then because of what I learned in high school, I'd come down court, and I'm looking and saying, okay, I got Zach on my left, Eric on my right. Eric's a spot-up shooter. Zach's a ball handler who can go to the hole. So now I'm looking at what the defense is doing and saying, okay, I'll give Eric the ball where he can shoot and not dribble. I'm going to give Zach the ball where he can dribble and not shoot if that's the advantage. And if neither one is open, maybe I'll go one-on-one and go down the middle. But that was like kind of me growing up. And I know I jumped around, but
all right. No, I mean, we love it because that's one of the best answers that we've ever gotten when we ask that question, because you touched on something a lot of people don't, and that's putting people around you in positions to succeed. I tried teaching my point guards that all the time. Like, we might not want to throw it to that person, that situation. So it's I love that you touched on that. And obviously you have a really good basketball mind, and a lot of the good basketball minds watch and study players. And I'm just curious, who is that player for you? Like, who would you look at and be like, I want to be like that guy?
Oh, I'm going to really go back for you. Bill Chamberlain.
Okay.
You know Bill Chamberlain?
Yeah, not Will. Bill. Yeah, Bill.
Bill Chamberlain went to my high school. He was older. Wow. And like, again, I'm telling you, I had a very fortunate high school career that most guys won't see. And what I mean by that is my high school coach would bring all the alum back. He'd bring in the local college players and the local pro players every Tuesday, Thursday night during the off season and all summer. So I'm in 10th grade playing against Bill Chamberlain, ex-Olympian. And Billy he's playing, and the whole time he's playing, he's also talking to me. Hey, Mike, don't do that. Hey, Mike, this is boom, boom, boom. So not only were they playing with me and against me, but they also were coaching and teaching me. So by the time I got to college, it was funny. I got to college, and I'm looking at the bigs, the seven-footers and all that, and I'm like, I didn't see you guys so many times. Most of you guys can't play. Your height was the only reason why you were on the court. And believe it or not, they were easy to score against because it was funny. Wayne McCoy taught me how to shoot over defenders who could jump in with 6'8", 6'9". So I'm shooting over these guys. And it was funny because who we were playing? We were playing Georgia, and I came down the middle of the 7 foot. It was there. And I remember I finger rolled him. And as I finger rolled him, I said, don't jump, stupid. Don't jump. Don't jump. You can see his arm swinging, and he's looking at me. I'm like, don't jump, stupid. But again, I had experienced so much as a high school player. And also, my high school coach was a firm believer in we got to play against the best competition. The only way you get better is going against the best competition. And the other thing that was really interesting, and most guys don't understand this, my practices were harder than games. Games were easy. Practices were hard. Our coach really prepared us for that. And like I said, I got to college. It was comical. I mean, because I got to college, and I'm reading about some of these guys in the SEC. You know, I'm reading about Kyle Macy and the other guys. And I'm getting down, and I'm going, okay, I don't see it. I've seen more from the guys I played with in high school, you know, played against, and also the pros that would come back. So I was not really – I'm not saying that these guys weren't good. I'm just saying that I didn't feel intimidated. I didn't feel like I didn't belong. I felt like I should be right where I was at doing what I was doing.
And that's saying a lot when you say that you learned a lot more playing against the guys at the high school level. Because, I mean, you obviously had the big 70-point game, 78, I think it was. Was it 78?
76.
I just got to know, what was different about that day? Because you seem like a do-it-all type guy, like to get your teammates involved. All right. So what was different about that day?
All right. It's really a great story about me. But everyone focuses on the 76. So I got to give you a little background here. I apologize because my background story is going to be a bit long, but I'll give it to you. I'm just laughing. When I was in 10th grade, some of my teammates had played for Riverside Church. And I'm quite sure if you talk to New York ball players, you've heard about Riverside Church. So I go down to Riverside Church with one of my high school classmates. I'm out there, quote unquote, trying out. And the guy who ran the program, I'm not going to get into names, virtually was just treating me like a piece of crap. Talk noise to me. Oh, you can't do this. Or you should know that. You should do this. And I decided, you know, for me, coming from Long Island into the city, that was a 2-hour commute. And I'm going, I'm taking a 2-hour commute to try out for a team to be dogged by the coach. F you, I'm not coming back. But it put a chip on my shoulder, really did. So every time we played against that organization, Riverside Church, scrimmages, and I was going for 50, 60. I mean, I was just going out to destroy. So going to my senior year, we're scrimmaging Riverside Church. All right, they come out to Long Island, we're scrimmaging them. I got maybe 20, 25 in the first quarter.
Oh, wow.
My high school coach sits me down and goes, that's not how we play basketball. All you're doing is shooting. You haven't rebounded. You haven't set up one of your brothers with an assist. You're not playing defense. Sit on the bench. That's not how we play. Come sit next to me. I'm like, coach, I could drop 70. I'm on my way. That's not how we do it. So my junior year, our coach had a thing where he said, look, I got all these guys on the team who are really talented. And one of the things he's always asked all of us to do was to, and I should mention, I was on my sophomore and junior year, I was on the team with two All-Americans. So it wasn't like, and I lovingly tell people, I was the third, fourth option. And if you look at the squad, I should have been the third or fourth option. And my ego, you know, I had an ego, but I was being realistic. So our coach had a thing where he said, I'm going to let my senior have a night where he goes off. He's allowed to do nothing but shoot. Give him the ball, let him shoot. So the year before, my teammate Wayne McCoy dropped 70. So the next year was my turn. So we were playing a team, and Rev said, all right, it's Mike's turn. Everybody give Mike the ball. And so I did something I had never done in high school, and that was all I did was shoot. Didn't play defense, didn't rebound. I literally was out of breath. And I dropped 76 points that night. And the funny part about it was I kind of got upset with my coach, the Rev, because he took me out with like 3 minutes to go in the game. And I told myself, I could have got 100. I could have got 100. He said, no, 76 is enough. But my real joy in all this is, in a high school of Long Island Lutheran's caliber, with the type of players that have come through there, I'm the only player in the school's history to lead my team in scoring, rebound, and assist in the same year.
Wow.
I really was a team ball player. Always was. Scoring was easy. Scoring's always been easy. But I was a team ball player, and the Rev made me into a team ball player.
So let me ask you this. So you have that 76-point game. Everybody knows to get you the ball. You think your teammates were cool about that because of you being that team player? You know, like the assists, the rebounds. It's like, let him get his flowers. Like, you think they were cool with it because of
my
that?
My teammates still talk about it. They talk about it more than I do. And every time they ask me, I'm like, you know, if it wasn't for my teammates, I wouldn't have got it. So the Rev said, do it. My teammates did it. And I'm telling you, they got more joy out of it than I did. And the reason being was, I really wasn't a selfish player. Now, don't get me wrong. I was the kind of guy that, and right or wrong, I would go into a game and say, okay, what do I have to do to help the team win? And if it was scoring, I'd score more. If it was rebounding, I'd rebound more. If it was, you know, assist, if Eric, if you were the hot hand and we needed you to score to win, I'm going to get you the ball. I'm going to set you up and get you the ball. So I was that player. And what was funny was, like, when I got to the pros, guys were like, I didn't know Mike could score like that. And I'm like, I could always score. I just, you know, scoring is easy. It really, and I'm not saying that to say, I'm just saying that, and please understand what I'm about to say. I was so fundamentally sound that scoring was easy. If a guy like you guys came to guard me, a little guard, I'd put you on my hip and take you to the hole and, you know, just shoot over the top of you. I literally would even tell you, Eric, I'm going over here. I'm going to put you on my hip. There's nothing you can do about it. And I'm going to go over the top and score.
You're pulling a bird on me.
I didn't try and out quick little guards. And then what would happen is they would say, okay, we can't leave Eric on Mike. Let's get somebody his size or bigger. And I would start smiling because no one my size or bigger could stay in front of me. So I was what you call, I guess, a matchup nightmare for most teams. And I thrived on that. You know, because of the way I was taught the game, I was always looking for the easier shot for either myself or my teammates. And the easier shot sometimes might be you posted up, Eric, you posted up against a center, or Zach posted up against somebody else, or Zach on the wing in his scoring spot. That might be the better option than me going one-on-one or two, and I'm looking to say, okay, that's the better option. That's the bigger mismatch. Let's go win the ball game.
So you're basically playing chess.
I was understanding
how to move the pieces around the board to be the most efficient in terms of being able to score in that case, right? You know what I mean?
Erica, you know what I'm going to say?
Yeah.
I train kids, and I tell them all the time, I'm like, I would take the ball and go through the jab series, and they would look at me. I'm like, you don't understand. I'm the puppet master. I'm moving you to where I want you to be so I can go do what I want to do. And a lot of them, I'm sorry, my dog. A lot of them, as I taught them, they're like, wow. I said, look, I'm going to take your quickness and turn it against you. And they're like, well, I said, because I said, I have one basic move, but there's 4 to 5 counter moves off that one move. I said, so if you take away my first move, I have a second, third, fourth option. So you're not my problem. In fact, when you're in front of me, I'm typically looking over your shoulder to see where the open space is and where I want to go or what I want to do. And that's what you'll find with ball players, understand how to move people around. And this was not with dribbling. I was taught to be very efficient, not to tear down the offense by going through my dribble series, but how to actually catch the ball, look around, go triple threat jab series, and move you and work you.
See, this is the stuff we love because it's breaking down the game. You know, and the game's very different nowadays than it is, you know, when you played, but it's cool to get that understanding of what it was like, how you thought. Talking about recruiting, I'm always interested because, you know, back then, no cell phones, no social media. Were your parents losing their minds about the landline ringing off the hook with colleges getting a hold of you? How many letters were you getting? Talk to us about who's number one, number two, number three in your head. Talk to us about that recruiting process.
I've got a really interesting recruiting story.
That's what I'd like to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I got a few of them, but one is, so I actually, you know, I had a 4-year All-American a year ahead of me. So I knew what to expect, but I didn't get those phone calls because they couldn't reach me by phone. Lefty Gazelle came to my high school to recruit Wayne McCoy in a limo with a full length fur on. He looked like a pimp. I mean, I'm just trying to give you an idea.
Paint the picture.
All right. So for me, Florida came in my junior. Florida came in my junior year because they were recruiting some other kids that I played with on AAU squad. So that's when they kind of saw me. And the head coach from Florida is a former Long Island guy. He actually was at Brentwood Fondling where he coached Mitch Kupchak. I can't remember the order of the visits, but I took my visit to the University of North Carolina. And after the visit, I literally gave Dean a verbal commitment. And I'm laughing because it's kind of funny. Dean said to me, and I didn't, you know, again, understand, I graduated high school at 17. So I wasn't even 18. I was very, in certain respects, immature. So Dean said to me, he said, Mike, we have two guards ahead of you, two point guards. We need a point guard. And they said, so it's not that we don't want you. It's that we're going to see what they're going to do first. And after we see what they're going to do, then we'll decide if we're going to, you know, if we sign them, then we're not going to sign you. But if we don't sign them, we're going to sign you. And me being the little, you know, and understand, I didn't care about, I didn't think about being a pro. I didn't think about, you know, whether the team was on TV and all the reputation. The only thing I thought about was, am I going to get a shot to play as a freshman? Am I going to get a shot to be on the court? And Dean looked at me and said, he told me who the two players were. And by the way, it wasn't Jimmy Black. Jimmy Black was, you know, I know Jimmy. It wasn't Jimmy Black. And they told me who the two guards were. And that just pissed me off because I was better than them.
Okay.
So in my anger, as my high school coach said, don't cut off your nose to spite your face. I said, F North Carolina, I'm going to Florida. And so I went to I committed to University of Florida, which was my second choice. And the reason being was, you're going to laugh again, the assistant coach at North Carolina's name was Dick Grubar. Dick Grubar played at North Carolina for 4 years. He was assistant coach at Florida. Grubar recruited me real hard. He was, like a lot of teams, the assistant coach was doing more of the coaching than the head coach. Grubar was the one coaching the team. Grubar came and saw me play and talked to me, and Grubar said, Mike, one, if you came to Florida, if you were at Florida right now, you'd be starting. So, okay, I said, I like that. He said, two, I think I can make you a pro. And I was like, really? Now, understand, being a pro basketball player wasn't in my mindset. But he said, I think I can make you a pro. And I was like, really? And he said, then I found out, and this is what I kind of alluded to earlier, they had Reggie Hanner in the middle, high school All-American. He was a year older than me. They recruited me, and then they went after a point guard who ended up being my roommate. And the point guard was from Florida. He was averaging 30 points a game. But here's what Grubar said to him. Grubar said to him, I got Reggie Hanna. You know Reggie. You played against him in high school. And I got this guard coming down from New York that gets flat-out score basketball. I need a point guard who's willing to sacrifice scoring to get them the ball. If you're willing to do that, I'm going to sign you. And he said, I'm willing to do that. So they signed him. So what they had penciled in was my roommate for point, me for two, Reggie at five, and a couple other players. Between me signing In the end of the school year, my senior year, Grubauer decided to retire. I didn't know what kind of impact it was going to have on me, but Grubauer retired. And they end up giving the job to my high school coach. He was assistant. The challenge that my high school coach and I both had was when we got down there, we didn't realize how much Grubauer was coaching the team. And so my high school coach, who was a great coach, didn't realize he was basically going to coach the team. And so what happened was they end up, you know, that old, I'm always going to play my seniors. So what they did was to play the two seniors. One of them could really play, but the other one, that the two guard spot wasn't worth a darn. He was a spot up shooter. But what they did was they moved me to point to keep that senior on the team. And it was probably the worst mistake they made. And he was the one, Eric and Zach, you'll appreciate this. I would come down on the fast break, like I told you, 3-on-2. And the two guard would say, watch, Milligan won't give me the ball. And so one day in practice, he said, you know, we come in on those fast breaks and Milligan won't give me the ball. Nada Blue, my high school coach, goes, he won't give you the ball because you don't know what to do with it. And I know that because I taught him.
That's awesome. That's awesome. That is absolutely hysterical. And it's funny too, because like, you know, I think all of us in this room have run that fast break before. And I know I've definitely been that guy where I'm like, nope, going that way. I know I've been that guy. And like nowadays it's hysterical because everybody just goes to the 3-point line, right? And it's like, well, who are you passing to that's going to shoot the three, right? But back in the day, you knew who could drive and make that basket, and you knew who would fumble the pass. Yep, you knew.
Well, again, I go back to when I was in high school. If any of us came down court and made that bad pass, our coach would say, come sit with me. That turnover is your fault, not his. You know he's not a good dribbler.
Yeah.
You know that's not where he should get the ball. Your fault. Come sit with me. And I can remember, you know, these are things that, and I always tell people, they say, I'm coaching a team, but they won't respond. I'm like, you know what makes players respond? The bench. Put them on the good bench. Point. And so many coaches today won't put players, I can't put him on the bench because he's my scorer. Trust me, you're doing him a disservice. Put him on the bench. Because what happens, and you guys see it at this nowadays in this marketplace in the basketball world, if you're not on the AAU team that's nationally recognized, scoring 25 points a game, you're not a good player. And then what you see is, and I've seen it so many times, I used to tell my son, don't look at this. You'll watch teams play and you'll hear the AAU coach yell, shoot, shoot, shoot. And I look at my son going, the kid's not a shooter. Yeah. He's not even a scorer. I said, the problem you're going to have is the kid's putting up a lot of points, so everyone thinks he can score. I said to my son, this one kid, I'm going, son, he's a 5'8 point guard who can't go to his left, and he's a volume shooter. He's not a good shooter. He's a volume shooter and plays no D. He was one of the top scorers coming out of State of California in high school. I won't say where he went to college because people might pick it up. He went to college and sat on the bench for 2 years. Transferred to another school, sat on the bench. When he would get in the game, he'd come down court, throw up 2 or 3 threes, and then go right back to the bench.
Yeah.
And I said to my son, I said, he never learned how to play the game. I said, the problem he has is his high school coach was more concerned about getting W's than he was about teaching the kid how to play and go to the next level. And that's my biggest complaint. Teach kids. Coach them. Help them get to the next, you know, at least at my high school, we all were going to the next level. So my coach said, I'm going to teach you to go to the next level. Dave Gavitt came in to recruit me and some other players, but he recruited me. In fact, that's one of the schools I was going to transfer to. And I'm sorry for cutting you off, Eric.
Oh, you're fine.
But Dave Gavitt said, I love Lujan players. They're academically ready and they're fundamentally sound to play right away. And that's what our reputation was.
I'll tell you this. You bring up a lot of great points. There's things that me and Zach miss greatly from you know, pro basketball. You know, Zach definitely teaches all of those intangibles for his high school girls, and they've gone from not knowing what the heck they were doing to like having banners up now. It's pretty impressive. And you're absolutely correct, man. Like, you know, not everybody's supposed to be a shooter. If you can't go to your left, I mean, there's certain guys that played in the NBA. Once they figured out they didn't have a left, then there went their career. And, well, he was putting up 30 a night. How? Well, once they figured out how to stop him, and he couldn't, you know, adjust to that, you know. So what I want to talk to you about real quick is the draft process. You know, you play at Florida, transfer to Tennessee State. You know, did you have a draft workout? Did you think you were going to get drafted? Because back in the day, everybody doesn't know this, but there was only two rounds now. But back then, there was multiple rounds. So people just take flyers on people. Did you have an idea that you were going to get drafted? Or like, talk us through that.
All right. Long story again. I get down to Florida my freshman year. They move me to Point. I was kind of shocked that I didn't make all SEC freshman team. I was really shocked. At the end of my freshman year, my high school coach and my head coach looked at me and said, you literally could be a lottery pick by the end of next year.
Wow.
Right. Both of them said, you need to work on your jump shot. My jump shot wasn't bad. You know what it really was? I didn't understand how to score from being a point guard. I hadn't figured that out yet. I was more concerned with running the club than I was with trying to figure out how to score. I was trying to figure out how to be a point guard. So it was funny. At one point, I was shooting 50% from the foul line. And it was basically, I would get up the foul line, and I'm throwing the ball up, and I'm already looking around what to do. So finally, about halfway through the season, I settled down. I think I made like 20 or 25 free throws in a row, ended up shooting like 69% for the year or whatever. I kind of got it up. But so my second year, they tried to move me off the point to the wing, to the two spot, and brought another guard in. No offense to him, but it didn't work out. So they ended up moving me back to point. Going into my junior year, they fired the coach, my sophomore year, brought in Sloan, and Sloan ran me off. Norm Sloan ran me off. So I transferred to Tennessee State. I sit out a year, but I'm back to playing the wing. I lead Tennessee State in scoring, rebounding from the wing spot, guard spot, and second in assists. So I'm back to being me. When I transferred to Tennessee State, my coach from Florida got fired, had called Tennessee State and said, look, the guy's a, you know, he's an NBA prospect. You know, he's looking to get drafted. When I left high school, I was in Playboy magazine as, you know, one of the top players to keep an eye on, blah, blah, blah. So I had some rep behind me. By the time I got to Tennessee State, I had no rep. It was gone. By the middle of my senior year, a couple agents came in to see me. And by the end of my senior year, I'm hoping to go to Port Smith or something like that. No invite. Just didn't get an invite.
Oh, wow.
So I'm going back. I end up training myself. So I'm training myself, and you're going to laugh when I say this. Everything I was doing to train myself is what I had learned in high school. I was training teammates in college from the stuff I learned in high school. They just had no idea how to do things. So I trained and got in shape. I was hoping to get drafted. I ended up getting drafted in the fifth round. Let's see. And it was funny. I got drafted in the fifth round, and my agent was, I'm not going to say his name, but my agent was a well-known agent. But he had never seen me play. Really, it was really interesting. He had never seen me play. He came in kind of like because the head coach called him, and, hey, we got to play here, blah, blah, blah. He came in and gave me a little speech about, hey, Mike, you know, I might represent you. And he talked to me, blah, blah, blah. And I said, great, you going to stay for the game? No, I'm not staying for the game. I'm going over to Tennessee to watch Dale Ellis. And again, my little ego, F Dale Ellis. I'm better than Dale Ellis. So, and by the way, I had played against Dale when I was at Florida. The draft comes, I get drafted, I do sign with that agent, and I'm back in New York playing on the summer league team. And before the first game, you know, we're up there practicing, there were pros on the team. You know, what he did was he put together a team, and he would have his, you know, pros he sponsored on it, and other guys he was recruiting or people that he wanted to represent. So we're in practice, and we're going up and down the court two or three different practices, and the guy who's running the team walks over and goes, "Don has no idea how good you are." He goes, "He's has no idea what you can do. You should go talk to him." And I said to him, "With all due respect, every guy in here would say the exact same thing. So me talking to him is not going to do much good. I said, he needs to see me play." He goes, "Well, I'm telling you, Don does not know how good you are." So our first pro-am game, I'm not going to say the guy's name. He's passed. Great guy. So don't. In fact, I'll say his name, Ray Williams. Okay. Now, Ray and I, in theory, in my mind, I'm a bigger version of Ray. You know, Ray's 6'3", I'm 6'5". You know, Ray rebounded. You know, Ray played small forward at Minnesota, led the team in rebounding with Kevin McHale. Ray and I had very similar games. So my agent was there watching, and I'm not saying, so let me say this, I outplayed Ray, all right? Maybe Ray was going through the motions because it was summer league. You know, I don't know. I just know I only have one speed. It's kind of, and I shouldn't say one speed. I only have one level. I'm going to give you 110%. In practice, I'm going to give 110%. In scrimmages, in games, that was the way I was raised. That's the way I was trained. So after the game, Don's all over me. Like, blah, 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 this, snap, all this. So he became a fan. I end up going to Philly. It was really interesting. I get to Philly. I'm a free agent. I'm going through the same thing all over again. No one knows me. Who are you? Blah, blah, blah. I'm killing them in rookie camp. Killing. I mean, I'm not trying to be funny. Killing. There were guys trying out that were also Sam Worthy was there. Sam was in camp with me. Oliver Mack was in camp with me. And they're like, "Mike, I can't believe you went to the fifth round. You should have been a lottery pick. You're killing them." Dwayne Scales was with the Knicks at the time. I knew Dwayne from when he was at LSU. He's like, "Yo, Mike, man, you about to get paid." So I went through all that. And then I got invited to vet camp. And vet camp was interesting because, you know, who I am showed up again. And what I mean by that is,
Really quick, I don't mean to cut you off, but vet camp, that's like basically the training camp roster. And they just came off a championship that year, if I'm not mistaken.
Right? Correct. Correct. Yeah. So the guards were in the backcourt were Maurice Cheeks, Andrew Toney, Frankie Edwards, and Clint Richardson. So that was who was already there. I'm laughing. It's kind of funny. By the time I get to vet camp, and what I'm about to say is going to show you kind of like what kind of ball player I was. I'm a two guard. Saddell's three threat made the team. I didn't. I'm pushing Saddell off, and I'm picking up Maurice Cheeks baseline to baseline at 6'5", 205, and I'm right in front of him, step for step. On the half court, I'm picking up Andrew Toney. Andrew Toney loved me. "Mike, you go hard. You block my shots. You get me ready." And then, and with all due respect, and I'm going to say this, and you guys will understand, there's a certain time when you're on the court with somebody who you're playing with, against, where you look at it and say, "There's nothing he can do to stop me. And I can shut him down anytime I want." I picked up that feeling while I was at Philly going against some of the guards. So, you know, I'm going to leave it at that. I'm not trying to sling mud. I just knew that I could do whatever I want whenever I wanted with them.
Right.
When I got cut, it was funny because when I got cut, Pat Williams said to me, called me and said, "Mike, you know, there's no question you're an NBA player. We don't have any room for you, blah, blah, blah." And they cut me. So, you know, there that was the end of my – and it was hard for me. You know, I went back the second year to Philly again, got cut. And at that point, I was done with basketball because, again, I'm being honest, it was hard for me to watch guys on TV play and get contracts and the money and all that. And I'm sitting at home with no job. And I'm going, I'm so much better than that player. I even had, at that point, the New Jersey Nets GM talking to my agent and said, "I think Milligan could be an all-star." And my agent was like, "Well, pick up the kid, you know, pick him up." He goes, "I can't pick him up." So I was that guy who you kind of read about that could really play, and everyone knew he could play, all even talked about it, but couldn't find a job.
Yeah, and my question is, when you're watching these guys on, you know, TV, and you're like, I could kill this guy, or I did kill that guy in training camp or whatever, when was the moment when you kind of stopped the dream of playing in the NBA, and did you know what you wanted to do after basketball? And because you did a lot after that. So my second part to that question is, what were some of the favorite things that you did after you figured out what you wanted to do? Because you did a lot.
Well, what happened was, when I got cut from Philly the second time, the previous year I went to the CBA. I got to the CBA, and this I will say, my coach was Cassie Russell. Cassie Russell started telling me, Mike, you know what the problem with your game is? I was like, no, but I imagine you're going to tell me. You don't know how to crab dribble, and you need to develop a hook shot. And I looked at Cassie, I'm like, I have no idea what you think about me. I've been playing facing the basket my whole entire life. I don't crab dribble. I said, I probably dribble better than the point guard you have starting on this team right now. I said, so this is not for me. I had hurt my back, so I couldn't. I hurt my back really bad, so I couldn't play. I tried to, but I couldn't go. And so they cut me. And it was really funny because the second year I went back to Philly, two of the players that were his stars on that CBA team were playing for New Jersey. I tried to break their backs, dunking, stealing the ball. But anyway, to get back to your question, after I got cut from Philly, I had a chance to go overseas. But at that time, most of the places overseas wanted bigs. They didn't want guards. They wanted 6'9", 6'10". They would come to our workout, but they wanted the bigs. And you know some of the guys. Mike Davis played for the Knicks. Audie Norris was with Portland. Dwayne Scales. They wanted them. They didn't want the guards. They're like, your guards are nice, but no.
Right.
So my high school coach at that time was coaching over in Europe, over in Sweden and Denmark. And he said, you come over here. And he said, but the competition is pretty much like what you saw in high school. And I was like, I got no interest in that. And so at that point, I realized, I said, well, you know what? I guess ball's over for me in terms of making the NBA. And I have no desire to be in the CBA or in these other places. So I guess it's time. So I ended up enrolling and going back to school and getting a job. The reason why I had to enroll back in school was Florida was on quarters. Tennessee State was on semesters. So when I left Florida and transferred to Tennessee State, I lost almost a year and a half of classes because credit-wise, it didn't add up. So even though I redshirted and sat out, I had to go up to Hofstra and finish up with my degree in accounting. I grew up right down the street from Hofstra University. In fact, that's another place I used to go up and play against the college guys when I was younger. And that got me. And so when I enrolled in Hofstra, my wife, at the time, she was my girlfriend, moved to New York with me. And I said, okay, I'm in school. I got to find a job. So I ended up getting a job with a financial planning firm. And I thought, this is pretty cool. I like this. And I literally went up to Hofstra and said, I want to change my major from accounting to finance. And they said, well, Mike, you can do that, but it's going to add another year. And I'm like, I've been in college long enough. I'm not looking for another year. And they said, well, you can go to Wall Street with a degree in accounting. I said, okay. So at that point, I left and I graduated with a degree in accounting, and I literally went to work for Dean Witter. And that's how I got my start on Wall Street.
You know, the interesting thing about that too is I watched that TikTok video with you and your daughter, and I thought it was very interesting about how you talked about you didn't think it was hard to make money, you know, and both you guys talked about you got to put the work in and whatnot, but they use a lot of terminology and things to make people feel like they can't make money in finance. You need Wall Street to be financially successful. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Correct. You know, one of the things which now you go back to kind of like the way I teach. And the way I teach, when I tell my students, I said, look, Wall Street is set up to make you think that you need to hire them to make money. I said, that's what they do. I said, the sad part about it is most of the guys there, guys, girls, especially when you're dealing with some of the brokers, are really salespeople. They themselves don't really know how to make money. They just basically follow. In fact, one of the major firms on the street now would tell you, if you work there, it would tell you, you sign the back of the check, not the front. All right. So once you sign the front of the check, then you can start telling what you want to do and how you want it done. Until then, you just follow instructions and do it our way. That's typically the Wall Street mentality. The other thing that's interesting about Wall Street, which is what I experienced at my current job, is I got to be careful I say this, but I'm going to say it. Predominantly white institution governed by white individuals, white males. It's not a place for black males. It's really not. I've seen guys get promotions that weren't qualified. One of my partners, when I first started my hedge fund, convinced everyone else that it was his idea and his thought process, and he's the one who did all this. That was kind of interesting. So we broke up and went our separate ways. And the other thing too is, because of the way I looked, especially at that age, guys, I've had people say to me, there's no way you know what you know. There's no way you're doing what you're doing. And it was the furthest thing from the truth. When I got to Wall Street, I took the same attitude to Wall Street that I had in basketball. And that was, I will do 2-a-days, 3-a-days. From 1 month, 6 months, I'll do it for a year. I'll do whatever it takes to get me ready for the game. All right? I'll train. I'll do self-evaluation. And this is one of the things I learned from my high school coach, which I think is key. My high school coach used to always say to us, go home and look in the mirror. Be honest with yourself. What's your biggest weakness? Whatever that weakness is, come to practice the next day and work on it. You might not ever be a great dribbler. You might not ever be a great shooter, but you can make yourself average. He said too many players go and work on their strengths and ignore their weaknesses. And so when I got to Wall Street, I took that same attitude. I'm doing 2-a-days. Where's my weakness? All right, go learn that. All right, where's your weakness now? Go learn that. So over time, I made myself a really good investor. Wall Street didn't want me to be a really good investor. They wanted me to basically just sell what they wanted me to sell. And so I had a lot of clashes. My clients would make money. I was making money, but I wasn't following what the firm wanted me to recommend to my clients. And a lot of times, again, this is just me because that's who I am. I would look at the product and say, I think this is not a quality product. I'm not going to put my clients in this because I don't think it's going to work. And I'm not here to help them lose money. I'm here to help them make money.
It's like rocking it's like rocking the boat, right? It's like they don't want you to rock the boat. And I'm sure, you know, I have friends that are professors, friends that are high level teachers, and they'll kind of go through some of the same stuff where they kind of feel like their hands are tied. You know, they kind of feel like what they want to do is not what they kind of can do, even though they know maybe morally it's the thing that they should do. You've had some issues lately. I wanted to give you the floor to share if you wanted to share about what has kind of happened, if you want to, and if you don't, that's fine too.
Sure, Eric. Let me say this. When I was in graduate school, now understand, I went to graduate school after being on Wall Street, after running a hedge fund. And the reason why I went to graduate school was I got tired of hearing people say, how do you know this? You can't know this. How'd you learn this? So I said, okay, so here's what I'll do. I'll go to graduate school. I'll get my MBA. And then you say, oh, okay, he learned it. You know, he got his MBA, so that's how he learned it. You know, I literally came at it the other direction. So I'm in graduate school, and I have a professor who's talking about investing and trading, and what he's saying is correct from a textbook. All right. But in the real world, it doesn't work that way. You know, it's almost like, okay, this is what the textbook says, and this is what logically you would do. But in the real world, it doesn't work that way. So I remember sitting here with one of my classmates. He was a bond manager. I was trading equities. And I remember saying to him, I said, boy, if I ever got into a classroom, I would put together a program that would be realistic, you know, try and get the same emotions, same feelings. And I'm a big believer, and you guys can tell, is we don't rise to our potential, as the saying goes by Marcus Aurelius. We fall to our level of training. So when I got to the university, I said, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start a program. This was like me. I'm on campus maybe four, five, 6 years. And I'm talking to my department chair. And I had started a investment club. I had started some other things with the students. And I said, I'm going to start an investment program where we're literally going to teach the students how to invest. Hands-on, they're going to figure out how to find the securities, when to buy, when to sell. They're going to construct a portfolio. Virtually, I literally called it an internship to working on Wall Street, either as an analyst or as a portfolio manager. That's what the whole plan was. I did the exact same thing I did when I taught basketball. All right. And it really is, I taught fundamentals all the way through, and I put them in what I call game situations. And the game situation was, and it really frustrated them, I would give them a stock and say, okay, write a buy report on this. Write a buy report. And I'm telling you, they were horrible. But I used to tell the students, I said, that's okay. If you already knew how to write a buy report, you wouldn't be in my class. You wouldn't be here. So my job is now is to show you how to do this. But you do the work, I'm going to correct you. So in other words, I'm showing you what to do and how to do it, but you got to go and put the work in. And as you put the work in and bring it back to me, I'm going to make adjustments and corrections and send you back out again. My philosophy, and the reason why I told them this, was when you guys graduate and go into the workforce, and something comes across your desk that you can't handle, you can't pick up the phone and call me and say, Professor Milligan, what should I do? I said, those days are gone. So I have to do everything I can to prepare you on how to solve problems on your own. So by the time these kids finish the program, if I showed you their research and what they were writing and what they were doing, you couldn't tell that from a Wall Street firm. They were that good. So the other thing I did, which I didn't mention, again, I learned it from my high school coach. My high school coach told us we were all brothers. And he preached to us like we were brothers. And he would say to us, your brother's open for a layup. Why would you pass your brother the ball? That's your brother. You're not going to share the ball with your brother? And you go, oh, yeah, that is my brother. So his whole thing was, he was a minister, was, and he would say to us, you think I'm teaching you basketball, but I'm really teaching you life. So with the program, I used to say to them all the time, I'm like, look, if you don't know how to handle this or what to do, talk to your teammate, your classmate. Let your classmate help you. And I used to tell my class, the other students, you want to learn something? Teach it. When you teach it, you'll learn it. And so I fostered this environment of self-starters, problem solvers, and the Wall Street firms were coming to hire them. And I mean, all of them were getting jobs. And they were all like, we can't believe how talented they are. Another thing I used to tell them, this is factual. When you apply for these jobs on Wall Street and they look at your resume, the first thing they're going to see is State University. I said, they're going to want to move you to the bottom of the pile. I said, my job is to help you get an interview. Because once you get that interview and you open your mouth, you're going to blow them away. I said, because I'm here to tell you, you know more than these other people. The problem that they have is their bias about a state university. That's not your problem. Go in there and blow them away. I've had students that went to job interviews and the firm literally said, we usually only hire MBA students. We're changing our policy and we're going to hire you. You blew all of them away. And when I watch basketball, I can't speak for you guys. One of the things I always notice is the player's fundamentals. And the thing that really, how can I put this? Well, put this way. Beilein at Michigan, before he left and went to the pros, was one of the few coaches that actually trained and taught fundamentals. Krzyzewski was another one. Krzyzewski was a coach where you saw kids sit on the bench for 3 or 4 years and by the time they were seniors, were able to actually play and compete, because evidently he was developing them and training them and practicing away from games. Then you have other coaches. I'm not going to name who. Oh, I'll name one. Norm Sloan was like this, my coach at Florida. Norm Sloan was like, Eric, you need to work on your dribbling. Eric, don't worry about it, Eric. I'm going to recruit and bring another player in for that spot. Don't worry about it. And so Sloan took the attitude of almost an NBA coach. I'm not going to teach you anything. If you can't do it, I'm just going to recruit over you and bring somebody else, and then you'll transfer out, and I'll keep going. A lot of college coaches are like that, especially now with the portal. They don't teach. They just recruit and try and bring in as much talent as they can and don't teach too much.
Feels like their hands are tied because they can't take that time to teach, because they lose that valuable time, especially with, like you said, the portal being the way the portal is nowadays. It's like you worked to teach, then that student leaves, athlete leaves, and then it's like, yeah, it's I wouldn't want to be a college coach right now.
But, you know, I disagree with that, and I'll tell you why. When I was coaching AAU ball, I had a lot of players that were going to the teams that were giving away sneakers and this and that. And I used to tell my players all the time, I'm like, okay, that's fine. I said, but understand this. I'm getting you ready for high school basketball. I'm getting you ready for the next level. I said, and the players who understand what I'm doing will stay. Those who are going for the other stuff, you know, good luck to you. But I know what I'm going to do is going to get you ready. And one of my players, he tells the story. He says, I was at practice. I was a freshman trying out for the varsity. He said, we were scrimmaging. I went to the hole on, you know, left-hand side. I banged my shoulder into the guy's chest and laid him up with the left hand. He said, the coach stopped practice and said, whoa, where'd you learn that? What are you doing? Freshmen don't do that. Where'd you learn that? He goes, well, Coach Mike taught me that. And he said, who's Coach Mike? He was my AAU coach. And it was comical because a lot of coaches out here in LA, they had no idea who I was. So I got no respect. I'm okay with that. And they would talk to me like I was a typical high school parent. Well, you're going to score more and this. Now I'm like, you don't know who you're talking. You really don't know who I am. And then one of my son's coaches out here in LA, I was trying to get another kid a college scholarship. And so I said, well, I spoke to Jeff Rulin. You know, we grew up together. I said, I spoke to Jeff Rulin. I said, Jeff's coaching, he could use a shooter. So the coach says, okay. I said, so Jeff said, give him a call. He wants to talk to you about the kid. So he calls Jeff. And after he gets done with Jeff, he goes, Jeff, by the way, Mr. Milligan, was he a decent ball player? And Jeff goes, I've known Mike since he was like in high school. The guy was a pro. He said, I don't know why he didn't last. He said, but the guy was a pro. And he goes, wow, he was that good, huh? And the sad part about it was, I used to work my son out every morning. His high school coach would never watch and never say anything. One day we had they had a coach in there that was recruiting from Gonzaga. After I got done working my son out, and it was a horrible workout that day, but after I got done working him out, the coach from Gonzaga walks over to me and goes, Mr. Milligan, I just want to introduce myself. That was one of the most impressive workouts I've ever, ever seen. I go, oh, thank you. And I literally said, thank you, coach, and walked out the door. And I'm going, I said to my son, see, your high school coach doesn't, your high school coach, I said, I don't know if he's threatened by me or what, but he's not willing to come and watch. I said, I'm willing to offer and show him things. Zach, I showed him the same thing about the defenses, changing defenses. And his comment to me was, my players aren't smart enough. And I was like, coach, I had seventh and eighth graders doing this. These are high school kids. What do you mean they're not smart enough? But I get off track, so let me get back. I started this program, and how can I put this? I started the program, and I developed it. And one of the things I did when I started the program, I was the guy that when my students would apply for jobs, they would put me down as a reference, which they should have. And the employer would call me and say, hey, you know, Mike, what do you think? You know, we're interviewing Zach, blah, blah, blah. We talk about Zach. At the end of the conversation, I go, by the way, if you love Zach, I got 13 more just like him. And they're like, really? What are you talking about? I said, let me explain to you my program and what we do here. And I would go through. I said, this is what we do, blah, 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 blah. And they're like, wow. I said, now, if you really want to have a relationship with us, which I really hope you do, what do you need me to teach your student, my students, to be ready and prepared to come to work for you? In other words, if you want, I'll be your internship. I'll run that program for you through my university. So in other words, I'm saying to them, let me be your JV coach. All right. Let me be the guy who gets them ready for varsity. I'll be that guy. Tell me what you want me to do and how you want it. I'll fit that into my coaching and training, and I'll get them ready so that when they get to the varsity, you'll say, wow, this is the kid who's ready to play. Not a kid who I got to teach how to play, but this kid's ready to play. So that's how I designed the program. And every year I would be asking them, what should we do? What can I do to improve this? What can I do? And then the other thing I would do is, as my students went out into the workforce, I always stayed in touch with them and I would say, okay, what should I have taught you or done for you to have you better prepared for this job? And I would ask them. And I would tell them all the time, I said, look, I'm not offended. I'm trying to make the program better. So tell me what I got to do that would have made it better for you. And I would incorporate that into my program. And that's how I built this thing to a point where you have Wall Street firms that literally, we need people. They would come in, and they still come in and hire the students out of our program. That's the program I built. And what's really interesting, that's the program I built. I'm the one who put together the curriculum. I'm the one who laid everything out. And yeah, I'm saying me because other people now are trying to claim my work as their own. I'm just not going to let that happen anymore.
Good for you. Yeah. And you shouldn't. You know, it's very easy and nowadays for people to do that, take the credit. It's like what you went through earlier in the conversation we had, you know, where the guy who's taking credit for what you were doing and your ideas. And to be honest with you, it's like what you do in the conversation we've had today, you know, it's like you have to fight for that because that's integrity, right? And that's something you built from the ground up.
And the funny thing is when everything's said and done and everything's over, like me as a basketball player, people don't remember what I did in the court. But the one thing, like, even when I was playing for Norm Sloan had me at 6'5", 200 pounds playing power forward, all right? But the one thing is the whole time I was playing out of position and struggling and all that, you never looked and said, Mike quit. Mike's not going hard. Mike always went hard. Mike always gave 110%. So that was never out there. I'm that guy who, if I'm in, I'm all the way in. If I'm not in, I'm all the way out. And so when I'm hearing on campus people saying, well, Mike, we all know it was you. And you know, so don't worry. I'm going, wait a minute. You all know it's me, but you got somebody else out there who's saying it's him. I said, and the sad part about it is, I'll take a basketball coach. If I'm a basketball coach and I'm doing all this, but you take credit for it, then guess what? You're slowing me down from getting a job, maybe as a head coach. You're slowing me down from maybe getting a job as a trainer for some of these guys in the pro. You actually, what you're doing is, and this is again, you're going to make me go someplace out of sports, and that is the reason why the African American community now has such a low generational wealth. And the reason why I have such a low generational wealth is, one, we don't get the jobs. Two, if we do get the jobs, we never get the credit for what we're doing. Somebody else gets the credit for it. And, you know, I'm not going to go into all that, but, you know, somebody else gets the credit for it, which means they also get the income from it. And so, case in point, in my case, I was getting paid $12,000 to run the program. I'm taking that money and paying for my daughter's tuition at her school. Part of her tuition. She had an academic scholarship, but she still has some money. I'm paying that. When they cut me off from that, what it did was, when they cut me off from the program and took away that, my daughter had to now go and take out student loans. Student loans affect your income as you graduate from college. I lost my reputation in the community to do any type of consulting work, any other work outside, because Mike must not know what he's doing. He got fired from a program that he started. So what did he do? What is he doing? There were rumors floating around on my campus and my department. There were rumors floating around in the community. And that's the shame of it. And what it also means is it stopped me from earning income in other areas, which is part of the generational wealth.
It's super frustrating because I don't think people understand the trickle down that you just explained. I think they just think, oh, well, yeah, well, he doesn't get to run that program anymore. And they don't realize all the trickle down to where you lose your trust. You know, other people don't want to take a chance on you. You know, they think, oh, he can't do this. Oh, he didn't even really create that program. This other guy did. What did he do? Yeah, that's awful.
Yep. You know, and the funny part is somebody said this to me. They said, Mike, if he had given you credit for running the program and then said, but I'm, you know, doing this and doing that and trying to make it better, I said, I would have had no problem with it. I said, but when you come out and you flatly say, my vision, my this, my that, I did this, I did that, it's just a slap in the face to me and the other people that might have been involved.
Yeah.
The other thing about it is, and if you have friends in academic, you know this, the other side of the coin is nobody's supposed to be able to come onto a campus and dictate what's being taught, how it's being taught. Nobody.
Yeah.
I mean, there are labor laws against that. There are laws. And that's just not at my university. That's at all universities. Now, private universities might be able to get away with a little bit more. But even the students, if students or faculty says anything, these are laws. Education is serious. Not everyone's a teacher. Not everyone's an educator. The other thing is not every basketball player can coach. In fact, some guys who are players are the worst coaches in the world.
Truth. Very true. Very true.
But you know what? Again, philosophy. My belief is the reason why some of the great players are the worst coaches in the world because they were doing things that other players can't, that they just assume that everyone can do. Yeah. And my belief is your players who have less ability but got more out of it tend to be better coaches because they understand how to get things out of ability, or how to get players to play that have less ability. No offense to you guys because you're probably great coaches and hopefully you were good players.
No, it's, you know what though, you're not wrong. I mean, it's kind of funny. I was a coach of my kids' little league team last year and we won the whole thing. And one of the other coaches was complaining and it was just kind of a ridiculous thing. And she was trying to get rules bent for her and all this other stuff. And her dad came up to me after the game and decided he was going to, you know, basically verbally attack me, you know, and my other coach and whatnot. And I listened to him. I was very respectful and I listened to what he had to say and whatnot. And, you know, she was an Olympian and, you know, played softball, Olympians, all this other stuff. And I almost wanted to say to him, like, you know, ma'am, it doesn't matter her accolades. It's like, it's obvious that she had no concept. Like their team was the worst team in the league. And obviously she didn't translate the game to those players. And I think that was the thing. It doesn't matter how great you were. It matters how you relate to your ball players, how you teach the game, the fundamentals, all that other stuff. And it's, you know, sometimes you just get better players and that happens. But, you know, I mean, it's, you know, so we're going to put five people in the outfield because, like, you need that help because, you know what I mean? It's like all these excuses. And I'm just laughing. Like, it's not about that. It's about the heart, too, right? How much people, you know, your coach. I mean, we don't, you know, I don't get paid to be out there. I lose money every time I'm out there coaching my kid, you know, and I don't care at all because to me, like you talked about, and I know Zach will agree with me 100% on this, it's about the opportunities you have to make those kids better people.
Correct.
I'm
going to add to that. I believe that your best coaches, especially with youth, are the ones who motivate the kids and make them feel good about themselves.
Yes.
Yeah.
100%.
I remember I said to my son's high school coach, he was a history teacher. And I said to him, let me understand this. A kid's in your class. They didn't do well on the test. So you call them out in front of the whole class and curse them out and tell them that they're dumb F this and that, and don't know what they're doing. I said, or do you say to that student, come see me at the class for some extra help and come during study hall hours and I'm going to give you some tutoring. So he looked at me, I go, that's coaching. If these kids could already do what you're trying to teach them, they'd be in the pros. They're young, they're learning. You have to teach them. And then when you teach them, you got to motivate them, make them feel good about themselves. I said, if you don't do that, if you make the... My son went to high school with this one kid. The kid could just flat out shoot a basketball. And it was a point where when the kid got into a game, if he shot the ball and missed it, the coach would take him out. So the kid now becomes more pressurized, like, I got to make the shot, which made him shoot even worse. Yeah. So one day, I bump into him one day and we're talking. He goes, "Mr. Milligan, my shot is just terrible. I don't know what to do." I'm like, "What are you talking about? When I first met you as a ninth grader, you were one of the best shooters I've ever seen. Go lock yourself into the gym like you did as a kid and put up some shots and go find your shot and come back. Stop listening to people. You're a shooter. That's what you do."
Short-term memory.
He goes, looked at me and said, "Oh, thank you, Mr. Milligan." And I'm like, "Dude, I don't understand this." I said, and I said to myself, "Now, I'm not asking you to rebound. I'm not asking you to be a great assist man. But what you are is you're a great shooter. Go be a great shooter. Don't let anybody talk." And he's like, "Well, they're trying to change my shot." I said, "Change your shot? Dude, too many people in your head. Lock them out, go in the gym, lock the door, put up some shots. You'll find your shot because you're a shooter. You just do what you do."
Yep.
And of course, the kid did that. And guess what? He's back, bang, bang, bang. That's the motivation. That's how you motivate. You don't, you know, if you embarrass a kid, if you embarrass them, if you tear them down. I mean, I remember one kid I was coaching in junior college, and he said to me, "I don't know, my game is just for shit, coach." I'm like, "Dude, if I had five of you, I could win a national championship. You're one of the best ball players I've ever seen." I said, "I don't care that you're 6 foot." I said, "You're 6 foot." And I told the head coach, "If we ever let you start a game, you'll lead the team in rebounding." And guess what happened? The kid didn't start one game, and at 6 feet, and I'm talking about with 6'10s on the court and all that, led the team in rebounding. I said to him, I said, "Coach, you can't teach that." And that's what that kid had. And a lot of coaches just don't understand how to work with that, how to teach it. And I don't know what the problem is. I don't know where the disconnect comes. But as somebody who sits in the sideline and watches, I'm like, "Dude, you just have no idea what's going on with your kids."
Yeah.
It's a shame. I mean, and it's really a shame because I've seen more kids screwed up in high school and AU basketball that you're sitting there going, "This kid's got all the potential in the world. I wish somebody would talk to him." And my wife would always say to me, "Well, Mike, go talk to him." I said, "Sherry, he's got four people in his ear right now. I'm just another talking head. It won't make a difference." I go, "And it's a shame because the people in his head have no idea what they're talking about." You know, anytime they see a guy 6'10", "If you're not dunking the ball, you're not playing hard." And I'm like, "You think every shot a 6'10 is going to take is going to be a dunk? You know, all right, it might be an AAU ball with the next guy tall as him at 6'4", but when he moves to the next level, it's not going to be the same way. We got to develop his rest of his shot. How about a turnaround jump shot? How about some reverse pivots and some forward pivots? How about some footwork?"
Right.
It's truth, but, man. It's absolute truth. You speak the truth. And I'll tell you right now, I super enjoyed our conversation today. You gave us a lot of great insight. I know the listeners, you know, enjoyed this show for sure. Is there anything you'd like to add or promote before we let you go?
Add or promote. God, I'm not good at this. Let me see it. Follow. I would just say stay tuned, you know, and I'll keep you guys abreast, you know, in terms of what's happening with me at work. The other thing which I also put out there, which is kind of interesting, and this would be for your listeners, I'm a life learner. And what I mean by that is I've got my MBA and I've decided, and I'm already back in school studying for my doctorate. I know I'm a bit old for it, but it's something I always wanted. It's something that my parents would be proud of. And by the way, I should mention, my mom and dad were first generation people who end up getting their master's, and my dad got his doctorate. First generation Americans. So, I mean, you know, African Americans. And so I just want to follow in their footsteps and make them proud. So that's, I guess, in terms of me, besides what's going on with with my challenge at work, I'm also in school part-time taking classes, and I will, you know, the scary part is I'll probably become a doctor and then retire.
That's all right though, man. Hey, Zach, is there anything you want to add before we let the professor go?
I just want to say thanks so much for your time. I super enjoyed, you know, the basketball stories and just enjoyed listening to your journey. And, you know, I'm sorry you're going through the unfortunate challenges at work, but I know it's all going to work out. And, you know, you're only going to get better from this, right? That's how we all do. So
hey, Zach,
thanks again, and we appreciate you.
One last thing I'll say, God never gives you more than you can handle. So I'm fine. I'm going to be fine. We're going to be fine. And I appreciate the wisdom, and I really did enjoy it. I have more stories. So anytime you guys want to have me back, feel free to call me. I enjoy this. There's two things I have a passion for, and that is basketball and finance. So anytime I get to talk about those things, I just start going.
Nice. Well, we appreciate it. We appreciate you being so generous with your time. And get a hold of us again when you know the legal stuff gets cleared up or things work out or whatnot. We can help you out with that too. We'll talk to you again for sure.
Sure. Sure. I love the chance to share. And the reason, again, I apologize for being long-winded, but one of the things that's happened to me is, as I talked about this, the number of my friends who've gone through this on different levels it knocked me over. I thought I was going through this, you know, alone. I've got dozens of friends who've either went through this or going through it right now. And it's unbelievable. I didn't realize how bad it was. So thank you for letting me share, and hopefully that other people will actually share and get through this and keep working.
I appreciate you. Hey, thanks for your time and enjoy your weekend, my friend.
I will. Thank you. You guys as well.
Take care.
Thank you. All right. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
You know, I know it's always going to be a good one when we start talking hoops right off the bat and we get really intelligent hoop talk where we start learning about the game and how to be a complete player. I don't think a lot of players talk about that as much as they should, and it's all being coached up. You know, that's really the difference between it being a complete player and not a complete player. And I think the professor really taught us a lot today about you know, how to excel with that, and then just in everyday life, taking those same goals and those same ideas and putting them into what he did with you know, with all the finance stuff he did and being a professor in college. I mean, it was a really, really cool, compelling conversation we had with him today.
Yeah, it's so beyond basketball, and I just loved how he talked about thinking the game, you know, like telling his son to put players in position to succeed, like, you know, the pass down to somebody cutting to the basket might not be a good finisher, that might not be the right player, rather than taking a good pull-up mid-range jump shot, you know, if that's more of your strength. So I love that he just touched on that, putting people in position to succeed, and the, you know, good players can put the ball in the basket, they can do all the things, but the great players can make people around them better, and I thought he touched on that today.
Yeah, and I mean, hopefully, you know, that translates to the younger generation instead of, you know, a 3-on-1 fast break that turns on to everybody just hanging out at the 3-point line and no one penetrating the basket. That's all you see nowadays, which is a shame. I mean, take the easy 2 instead of trying to take the 3. That might not be the easier basket, you know what I mean? So hopefully the younger listeners get something out of that. When the odds are in your favor, use them to your advantage, you know? Right. And the knowledge of the game is important. It really, really, really is important. Another thing that's absolutely important is, you know, we haven't been doing a lot of these lately. I mean, I've been guilty. I've been super busy and whatnot, but we're still charting, which is crazy. So you guys are listening, you're telling friends, and Gene Smith is like our one-man army in terms of getting us guests and things like that. But it's all greatly appreciated, and it's just still a trip every day to wake up to an email showing how many countries we're charting in every morning. It's beyond crazy. So thank you, listeners, for that.
Yeah, and big thanks to Gene Smith, too. He's been a huge help with my girls. He's actually going to be a guest speaker for my girls' basketball team. You know, we just had tryouts, so he's going to be speaking to them. And, you know, he's just been such a positive, both for the podcast, but also for my basketball team. So just a great guy. I really appreciate him.
That's awesome. Is he speaking virtually or is he speaking in person?
Yeah, it's through a Zoom, like a little video that I'm showing all the girls, just, you know, talking about roles and importance of defense and team energy, things like that. Just all the important little intangibles that, you know, I think go beyond the talent and beyond the playing time. Like, you can make yourself a very valuable part of the game, even if you don't play a second. And that's just kind of what we're trying to preach.
And it's kind of funny, too, because like all those guys from that time period, like it's all ingrained into their heads.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they did. He won a national championship. He's got to know something. You know, we're trying to do the same thing. So he's got to know something.
You would hope, right?
Learn from the best players and the best teams, right?
Yeah, if you think you're the best, there's always someone smarter than you in the room. Always remember that, right? There's always somebody that you can learn from. And if you think that way, you will go very far in life. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening. Is there anything you want to add before we go?
No, just big thanks to our listeners. Big thanks to Mike for coming on the show. Really appreciate him. I hope we'll have him back soon. And thank you, my friend, for, you know, sticking with me for 4 years. Most people get tired of me after 4 years, so I appreciate it.
4 years, man. That's crazy. I still remember day one of meeting up at meeting up at Morning Ball and you being like, hey, I bought a bunch of equipment, so we're going to do that podcast?
Yeah, and we don't even use the equipment.
No, I was going to say, COVID changed all of that. Good Lord.
Right.
Yeah, it's been a long trip, man, but really cool one too. And I mean, I never thought in a million years we'd get to interview people like Charlie Ward and Oscar Schmidt and Chris Herring.
Mike Milligan.
Yeah. I mean, think about all the guys we get to interview that we never thought we would be able to. We were just talking about basketball stuff when we first started. And I think it all started with Dwight James, right?
Yeah, Dwight James is our first guest, and Rob Benson, then Rex Walters, and it just kind of spiraled into a lot of amazing guests, and they've all added something new. They've all added something different. Like, every single guest, I learned something new. Like, today, you know, you always learn something new. And I had a great basketball talk with Mike before the podcast about a week or two back, and he gave me a lot of great insight on stuff to do with my team. So this is why I do the podcast. I just love learning about it. It's great stuff.
Yeah, and he seems like that guy that, like, right off the bat, it's so easy to grab knowledge from him. He just in our conversation today, it just was like, yeah, you could sit in a room with that guy for an hour, and if you didn't walk away with a bunch, you weren't paying attention.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But simple. He understands how to really make things simple for everybody to understand, and I think that's a huge point in life, man. Don't complicate things if you don't need to. The message is what you need to get across, not how intelligently you can put the message across, get the message across. So, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening, and as always, word of mouth is always great, so spread it away. Social media algorithms are the worst in the world nowadays, but if you do want to share us on social media, we would totally appreciate that. Be good to yourselves. Be good to each other. Take care of each other. Be safe out there. Play some basketball. And we'll see you on the next podcast. Peace.